Hi, everybody. My name is Diane Allison. I'm a grateful member of the World Out Fellowship of Al-Anon Family Groups. Amen. And my home groups are in Brentwood, Tennessee, even though I'm from Nashville. I attend several meetings on a regular basis and do this work in those groups. And so I don't have just one home group. I participate in three different ones. I'd like to start with a moment just of silence, but I know we didn't get the serenity prayer in, so if you would oblige me, let's invite our higher power into this room, if you would, and into my words and take me out of it, please. Thanks. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you. Yeah, I get nervous too. Once the steps are read, then it comes in and kicks in. And I'm like, okay, it'll settle down in a minute. Thank you, Kelly, for speaking last night. I love hearing the other side of these stories and hearing people's, experience, strength, and hope. It's always a wonderful thing to know that there is solution. And I'm looking forward to Marty's talk tomorrow, and Mike you'll get to hear tonight if you haven't. I hope you can make that. He's not the reason I was so crazy, but he's the reason I got into these rooms, and I'm grateful for that. The disease of alcoholism brought me here, and I didn't think I was ever going to be the one to say that I was grateful for that, and I am today. So echoing. I want to thank the committee for having Mike and I here. It's such a beautiful place and serene. It's always nice to come up here and just kind of reconnect and to see familiar faces. This fellowship brings us into, such an expanded family, extended family that it's just taught me so much, and I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you, Andrew, for a sweet introduction, and I've enjoyed getting to know you too. And it's for me, it's when I come to these places, it's I'm just meeting family members I haven't met. I really think of everybody as family, and thank you to the used to call tapers. I don't know what it's not CDers or whatever you want to say it now. Scott and Bo is. We've lived off these CDs for many years, and I popped in an old CD that I'd gotten from an Al-Anon that's gone to the big meeting in the sky, and just to reconnect to those things. I love having these old tapers of experience, strength, and hope of people that are no longer with us, too, and to listen to their stories. Never did I know I was going to be behind the podium. That's not what it is, but I'm here first to be of service, and hopefully somebody will hear what it is I'm supposed to say today. I don't plan out this story, even though Marty reminded me we wake up telling our stories, and I did wake up thinking, oh, I gotta say that, oh, I gotta say this, oh, no, God, you're in charge. So take me out of it, and I had to take off my mascara that I put on this morning because I realized the tears flow, and you would see me like a little ghost or whatever, looking like a Halloween costume by the end of the thing. So I had to take it off. So hopefully the tears won't come so much, but I know that's just God opening up my heart. Okay, I think that's a start. I'm from a very large family. I was number 8 of 12 children. I have a twin sister. There's 8 girls and 4 boys, and from the oldest to the youngest is 12 and a half years. So we were very close and still are today, with the exception of my oldest brother who's passed away. We get together as much as possible. The majority of us live in Tennessee and Alabama, and it's just kind of spread out that way, and a few misplaced people here and there. I had a fun life. I mean, growing up, it was always something to do, somebody to fight with, somebody to play with. You know, we didn't have to have neighbors, even though the neighbors all came to our house or we went to their houses. There was always just a lot of people. I was always surrounded by people. I didn't ever know anything like alone time. There was not, that just wasn't part of my life. I always shared a room with someone, and never had a room to myself till, gosh, I left college and got to be by myself in quiet and peace. And I didn't know what that was like, because my house, there was always noise, always something going on. Alcohol was part of the family, you know, part of a relaxation thing for my dad when he came home. He would always have a drink when he came home and sit down, and we learned to make his drinks, and he'd have one or two, relax, and that was the way he relaxed every day. And I never saw him drunk. My parents, my mom was like me, little, and she couldn't drink, get one drink in her, and she started being silly. And that was it. She wouldn't have any more. And I never saw my dad really change. You know, alcohol didn't ever change him. So alcohol was okay. And we had like birthdays and celebrations. Like we'd all get a little sip of something with maybe watered down wine or something as a toast or something. And so we grew up, that was acceptable. When I was in high school, it was back in the late 60s, alcohol was part of the high school parties. The guys I dated always had a drink, and I too. When I was 18, the drinking age changed to 18, which was nice, and that was when I was in college. But we always just, that was part of it. And I look back over when I'm doing inventories of boyfriends and my love life and all that stuff. I always was curious, because I had this one guy that I dated for a short period of time, and he was great. I mean, there was nothing wrong. He's successful, he's cute, he was popular and all this stuff. There was something missing in that relationship, and I would double date with my sister, and I could never figure out, why didn't I like him? You know, and he wrote me this letter saying, I know you don't like me and you like somebody else, but you know, this thing. And I thought, no, that's not true. But looking back, I know what was missing. Alcohol. It was no fun. Alcohol was for fun. It was always something to do and have fun. And there was no alcohol in those dates. He was, you know, a normal person, I guess, and we didn't do that. So it was a whole different world for me, because I didn't know. You're supposed to have a party, and alcohol was always part of it. Now, I'm a real control freak, and when I have alcohol, I start feeling it after one or maybe two, and I know it's time to stop, because I don't want, you know, once I start feeling it, I know I'm going to change into something I may not want to be. I got to see sisters or friends, like Mike calls, overshoot the mark, and they would get sick, they'd throw up, they'd cry, they'd be embarrassed, they wouldn't remember, they'd ask us the next day what happened and all this stuff. And I was like, God, I don't want to be like that, because I want to remember what I did, and I don't want to embarrass myself. I'm such a control freak. So as soon as I feel alcohol, that's my message, you know, stop. You don't want any more. I don't like the way I feel when I have more than, if I pass that little point about, oh, I can have another drink. No, I can't. I don't like hangovers. I don't like, you know, they just... But that didn't stop me from participating. I was one of those people that if you were drinking, I was drinking. I wanted to be part of the crowd. I go along with other people. I didn't know who I really was. I got to be what you wanted me to be. And that late 60s, early 70s, a lot of the other stuff came into, you know, the scene. Actually, in college, I was like one of the hippies. Let me get my water. And love, peace, all that stuff. Oh, let me go digress a minute. I was raised in a all-girls high school, and it was very strict. It was a religious school, and they taught me a lot of values and morals and stuff, what was right, what was wrong. And I was a good girl, because I lived in fear. I knew that if I misbehaved or did what you told me I shouldn't be doing, I was going to go to hell. So fear ruled my life. It really did. I'm getting echoing. I don't know if y'all are or not, but so I was a good girl, you know. The drinking and that stuff, that was okay, you know, everybody did that, even though it was not allowed at the time. But when I got to college, my dad was very strict. I mean, we lived in fear of him, you know. I think my date one time brought me home late, and it was probably 3 minutes late, and he never brought me home late after that because my dad met us at the door and gave him the whatever. I don't know what he said to him, but I know I never was late again. And we lived in fear of my dad, too, and what he would do because he was the disciplinarian. You know, I'd gotten the belt from him and never wanted to do that. So that was the thing. But when I went to college now, parents weren't there. Church wasn't there. We were raised in the church. But I didn't have to go. Nobody was looking after me. And so I stopped going to church. I stopped going to church, I realized, looking back, I think because I was starting to do those things that I knew that God wouldn't approve of. And if I didn't go to church, I didn't have to think about it. And I could just, you know, kind of dismiss all that. And I didn't realize that's what I was doing, but I think that's I didn't want to have those guilty, go to church and have them remind me of what I was doing wrong. Because college was somebody opened the door and let the bird out of the cage, and I did a lot of stuff that I didn't think I would have done, and it changed. And you know, alcohol was a part of that, and other things were a part of that too. And I know that was a lot of the reasons I went as wild as I did and stuff when I did. But I had fun. I mean, it was great. Did a whole different community. And I didn't do as well in school for some reason, you know, that kind of, I didn't do the sorority thing because I'd done that in high school. Instead of sorority, I joined a fraternity, and I did that by becoming a little sister of a fraternity, and boy, that was fun. I have four brothers, and we were close, and I had fun because two of those brothers were in that fraternity. My twin and I both became little sisters, and every day after class, I'd get the bus to drop us off, you know, the shuttle bus at the fraternity house, not at my dorm, but at the fraternity house. And we'd play cards. I learned how to play cards. I learned how to cook. I'd go back in the kitchen and the cooks would teach me how to cook. You know, I loved going back there and letting them talk to me and stuff and teach me how to do things. Even though I got that at home before, but I don't know, those were the only women in the fraternity house, and I could kind of have that community there too. But I spent a lot of time there, and as a result, I didn't do very well in my grades, and my second year, I had a friend tell me, I've got this guy I want you to meet. I think you guys would really hit it off, with the exception he was in Memphis and I was in Knoxville. And so we had a blind date, finally at spring break, and this is the Mike who's sitting here today. We had our first date. And, I mean, we were just smitten with each other. It was like he would drive up from Memphis the week of exams to see me, and that's a long drive. And you talk about that speeding ticket, maybe he'll talk about his that he got from Memphis to Knoxville coming. He had to turn around. He was too drunk. That should have been a sign for me somewhere, but it didn't. But he was coming up to visit me, and then he called and says, no, we've got to go back, because he was too drunk. And the next thing I know, he's coming into my door, and a few hours later, and I'm like, what? He was drunk, and they decided to make it in 4 hours to Knoxville from Memphis, which, if you know, it's pretty far. And I took a bus to Memphis from Knoxville to go to a concert, you know, for our second date. It was like, we were just crazy, and but there was something there, and I just heard from this lady, and I don't hear from her. We get together like usually once a year to celebrate Christmas with friends, and she was actually a roommate of mine after I left college, because when I met Mike, he was finishing up and he was going to be in Nashville, so I figured, of course, I needed to be in Nashville, right? If we were dating, I needed to be in Nashville. I didn't need to be in Knoxville. Maybe he'd find somebody in Nashville, so I better stay in Nashville where I can keep an eye on him, and we can, you know, because we're going to ride off into the sunset and be happily ever, you know, married forever and have kids, you know, six kids and all this stuff. I already had it planned. you know, it's just, we're on this road. So I quit college, and it was a good excuse anyway, because I was on academic probation, and, you know, that kind of had something to do with it, too. I probably wasn't going to make it much further, being the what I was doing. And so, anyway, I heard from her this morning. She sent me a text asking about my son, which I haven't heard from her in months, months, and months. It was funny, and as a result, I got to send her a text back about my son in California and the fires and all, and I said, by the way, I've never thanked you probably sufficiently for introducing us. You know, thank you for this grand life that you started. And she was, here they go. She texted back. She said, wow, that's so sweet. You know, it brought tears to my eyes. I'm thinking, it's not me. It's this program. It's my higher power. It's what God, what you guys have taught me to do. Make the good amends. You don't just have to make the amends where you, you know, you can thank people for the things that they've done for you. And I had a sponsor who taught me that, the good amends. Anyway, so I got to do that today and, you know, thank her and touch her. She made it into the rooms for a couple of months and then got better and didn't have to come back. So I don't know if she belongs here or not, but I got to do that this morning and it was special. Okay, go back into coming back to Nashville. So I've got this really good way of, I guess it's kind of a defect maybe, that I can make me look really good rather than being really honest. It's all about looking good. And I came home from college I left the school knowing I probably wasn't going to come back after my sophomore year because I was madly in love with this man. And we were going to be together, so I probably wouldn't be back. And he was going to take care of me, and we'd be fine. Now, he hadn't told me any of this, but it was here, you know. It's like what Larsine says, it's up here, and it just came, and it's a fact. And it's just the way my mind works. And so I told my parents, let them know that I wasn't going to be going back to school, and I made it look like I was a martyr. You know, because they didn't need to pay for another year of college. You know, I would come home. I mean, I was number 8, so we all went to college, so I can't imagine what the... And it didn't cost that much back then to go, but it was... I was going to, you know, come home and get a job and pay my own way, and they didn't have to pay for me. And I was going to live at home for a while until that lasted about 3 months, and then I couldn't do the rural thing because I'd been in college by myself for 2 years and on my own, and I couldn't do this curfew thing and all that kind of stuff. And I couldn't do the things I wanted to do, probably, too, and still be under their roof. And so I moved into an apartment with this lady I was just telling you about that had introduced us, and we got an apartment because she came home, too. She'd met somebody, and we both were just so grown up. We were like 19, and I thought I was so old. And I did. I got a job working for my dad. I decided I'd help run his office. He needed that. His secretary was getting ready to have twins and would be leaving. And so, you know, I told him I'd run his office, you know. Did I have training for that? No, but that doesn't matter. You know, we can figure it all out. I became his secretary, I became his bill, you know, did the bills, and payrolls. I did it all. I mean, it was like I scheduled the appointments. My dad was a doctor, and so I helped run his lab. It's just, Al-Anons, we are good managers. We just jump in there and take over, whether we know how to do it or not. But I think I was successful at it enough, and because I stayed there, and he kept me on. And Mike and I had a great time. He was working for his dad, his company, and I was working, so we had money coming in. We didn't really have any expenses. He had his apartment, I had my apartment. There was lots of partying to do, you know, no children yet or anything. We weren't married either, so I wasn't going to have children, hopefully, before that, but anyway. we had 2 years of what I considered were on the road to marriage, you know. Next step is going to be marriage. And but I think Mike had different ideas. And there were some flags popping up here and there. I'd see this and see that. But I had this real keen way of seeing something, and in the middle of there to here, it's changed. It totally flips, and I've made an excuse for why I saw that, or a reason for it, and so that those flags turned into, one of the Al-Anons used to talk about the red flags popping up. Well, they were green flags all of a sudden. They were okay, because I had convinced myself that I wasn't seeing what I was seeing, and that would never happen, and so just go on and maybe talk to him about it, and he would explain it, and I'd believe it. So, you know, that's just the way I could do, you know, because that's what I wanted to believe. That happened 2 years into this dating, just about right at 2 years, Mike broke up with me. And I was in shock. I was like, why? I mean, I'm perfect, you're perfect, we're perfect. Why would you break up with me? Well, he wouldn't tell me. He just said, I got to break up, which kind of freaked me out, but that's okay. I was a hippie, see, remember? I was peace, love, everything's okay, you know. I'm floating, it doesn't matter. Hide any feelings that I have, they're really not there. It was just crazy. And so, I say in my story, usually it's a que sera. That's back then, que sera, sera. What will be, you know. I convinced myself he'd come back later anyway, so go ahead and have fun. If it was meant to be, I would tell myself, if it was meant to be. And so I kind of put probably. Now, I'm saying this now looking back. I can see I had a plan how to get him back. I would date other guys. I'd have lots. I moved into, when we broke up, that friend and I, she asked me to move out, and I couldn't figure out why. And maybe because he was going to be still in her life as a friend, and that would be uncomfortable for them. I don't know. But she asked me to move, and so I got an apartment with somebody I think belongs in the other rooms. Because what parties we had at this first place, man, did our parties ramp up. And I had my sister, I would say, oh, I won't drink too much because, you know, she's the one that was my example of what will happen to me if I drink too much. She, and I mean, every weekend was party, other stuff, and I'd invite Mike, you know, and I'd have a date, and he wouldn't. He'd have his friends. And I would not notice him, supposedly, and I'd be having a fabulous time with this guy, you know, this other guy, so that he would see me, so he would know what he was missing, and all those things. Now, I didn't do that intentionally. It was kind of subconsciously maybe out there. I don't know. I can look back and say I probably was doing it. And so that went on for about a year. And at the end of a year of our breakup and stuff, Mike and I get this phone call at my office, at my dad's office. Now, my dad knew I'd broken up with Mike and stuff, and I get this phone call that says, Diane, this is George, and Mike's had his wisdom teeth out, and he needs you to come take care of him. And I go, wait, George who? Mike who? What are you talking about? And they said, well, this is George that works with Mike. In his office, and he's had his wisdom teeth out, and he asked me to call you to come take care of him. Well, okay, that's the Al-Anon call, take care of me. I'm sorry, you need me, you're calling to me, I can fix it. Well, then it clicked in. Oh, that's right, Mike had mentioned he was having his wisdom teeth out. Well, his parents were out of town, his sisters were out of town. Nobody was there to take care of him, so he needed me. I was going to save him today, you know. So I tell my dad, I'm going to be gone, it's lunch hour, I'll be back in an hour. And he's like, now in this, the Mike you broke up with, he broke your heart, and you're going over there to do what? And I'm like, well, he needs me, there's nobody. I'm sure he had 1,000 people he could have called, but he called me. Now, he was under the influence of whatever it is they put him under, you know, to pull all his teeth out or whatever, but his wisdom teeth. And so he'll talk about that later. And so my dad says, why are you going? I said, I got in lunch hour. I'll be back in an hour. I'll see you. I just took off. And I go over there and I line up some people to come sit with him so I can go back to work. And I tell him I'll bring him some dinner later on. Little did I know, wisdom teeth, you don't want dinner that night, you know, but I was going to bring him dinner. I was still going to take care of him. Nobody else could do this. And anyway, I go back. Oh, when I'm over there for that little lunch hour that I'm there, he can't talk, so I've got him, you know. And he can only write. And he's writing, I love you, I want you back, please move in with me. Nah, 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 nah. Now, is that what I wanted to hear? Of course, it was exactly what I had planned and hoped for and prayed for. But there was a problem, just a little minor problem. I had this boyfriend that was living with me at the time. And that was just a little bit of a problem. So I go home after work and I tell my boyfriend, you know, Mike's had his wisdom teeth out. I've got to go take him some dinner and then I'll be home. And that didn't go so well with him. He was like, if you leave here, I'm going to be gone when you come home. And I'm like, I'm only taking him dinner. I will be back. It's innocent. There's nothing to it. And he didn't believe me. And you know, for me, I didn't know whether he'd really be gone or not. And so I took him. Anyway, give me a ultimatum, and I'm going to jump on it, and I'm going, I'll try you out, because I don't like ultimatums. And so I come back, he's gone. And so I didn't have to break up with him. He did it. I didn't choose to. Mike had told me, you know, he still wanted me back, and I said, you know, I've still got so-and-so living with me. And well, 3 days later, I did move in with him. So that's how sick I was, okay? That's how sick I was. Little did I know why we'd even broken up a year before. He didn't ever tell me. And so I figured it was somebody else, you know, another girl or whatever. And so I guess my mom got word of it somehow, and I think she got word of it. I figured out maybe because Mike's mom happened to call his apartment in the morning, one morning. This is before caller ID, so you answered the phone. Mike was gone, so you know, maybe I thought it was him calling. I answered the phone, and it was his mom, and I mean, I was 22 at this time, and I figured I'd been on my own. I was fine, but, you know, I answered the phone, and she was very sweet. But I think she may have gotten word over to my mom or something. Somehow my mom got word. So I was over at the house, and she said, I want to talk to you. She said, are you living with Mike? And I was like, well, if you're asking, I'm guessing you know it. And so I'm going to be honest with you, yes. I said, I am, because you know, we dated for 2 years. We broke up. I don't know why. I don't know whether we're going to get, you know, this is going to continue on. I want to know if I can live with this man, you know, if it's going to work out. And anyway, because of reasons I know now today, I didn't know back then, you know, she kind of said, well, now he'll never marry you, whatever. I used to say that she disowned me. I don't know if maybe she... It was just so against her values and stuff, or that she was really in fear of what might happen to me, because older sisters, I know stories now from my older sisters that similar things had happened and they got hurt from it, and she didn't want to hurt. I'm saying she just didn't want me to hurt and have those same experiences, and so she couldn't be around me or I couldn't be around her. I don't know which. You know, I've got a memory that can make up things. So I really don't know that she disowned me, but I knew we weren't around, you know. And so anyway, I remember writing her a letter saying, you know, Mom, if this is a mistake, I've got to learn from my own mistakes. You can't just tell me it's wrong. I've got to know this. And if it's wrong, I'll find out. I'll figure it out. and because I really love him and everything, and I want to know if this is going to work. I do remember that. And 3 months later, Mike again was on something. Not that he wasn't on something all the time, but 3 months later, we were at his parents' farm and stuff, and out riding horses and going to go check on some stuff. And out of the blue, we're standing by this little pond, and he just asked me to marry him out of the blue. And it was out of the blue for him, too. He didn't know these words were going to come out of his mouth, he says. And he just asked me to marry him. And I was like, and I just gave him a big old hug. And he said, well, what kind of answer is that? Is that a yes or a no? And I'm like, yes, you know, of course. And so he says, well, when? And I know my dad was going to be out of town, you know, in 3 months, that certain date. And I said, well, this is a day I could get off for a honeymoon and stuff. And so, I mean, it was that quick. We decided on a date. Not that we'd worked it out with the church or parents or anything. We just, it's what we did back then. So we go home, and he goes to my dad and asks for my hand in marriage. And oh, my dad was so bad. Mike just told me this recently, that he said when he went in there, I was outside. We had a swimming pool, and I was sitting out there with my mom. And so I was okay, but I hadn't told her. I was waiting for them to come out. And it took him about an hour to come out. And I had to, you know, I couldn't figure out what was going on in there, you know, because I didn't know what my dad, he was pretty strict what he was going to be saying or doing. And Mike tells me today, my dad went in there and said, let's make them sweat. They were in there drinking while I'm out there with my mom waiting for them to come out and say that it was okay. He told me that. I was like, I can't believe that. But yeah, I can't believe that. So anyway, 3 months later, we got married. And we were all fun. Everything was going to be good, and everything was going to be grand. We're going to have a great time. We're going to have 6 kids and all this stuff. And see, I'm from such a big family. I figured 6 was a small family. But see, I hadn't checked that out with him. This is the way I operate. I've got it all worked out here, and I'll let you know as it goes on and unfolds. But, you know, a couple of years later into, I mean, we were, life was good. You know, a year after I think we got married, we found our house that we're actually still in today, and which was a mile and a half from my parents, which was wonderful. And we, you know, partied a lot, and but we were both, you know, the kind that went to work every day. We never missed a day of work. We were good about that. And 3 years into the marriage, we had our first son. And man, that was just what I wanted. My mom was a, you know, stay-at-home mom, of course, with 12. And I got to be a stay-at-home mom. I love babies. I love children. I'd had, you know, 4 younger than me at home that I helped take care of, too, and play mom, too, and all that stuff. So that's just kind of where I am. And I've always been, I love being around children. You get me in a room full of little ones, I'm in heaven. And so I had my son, and all was well. And 3 years later, I had my second son, 3.5 years later. So I had these 2 boys, and they were just the love of my life. Life was grand. And of course, I stopped doing any of those things, other things. And of course, my doctor told me, have a glass of wine when you're pregnant, you know, every night. That's fine. It relaxes you. You'll have less stress. And so I would have 1 glass of wine every night or whenever. But so that was the only thing really drinking-wise, and I didn't do anything else. I decided to put all those other things off. As a mom, I'm a responsible mom, and now I'm going to be in charge, and I was the room mom. And things were, he was still partying as hard as we were before, and he was not coming home as early as he used to be, and there was starting to be a lot of stress at work on his part. And he was starting to become suicidal and depressed and all this stuff that goes along with this disease. Just other symptoms that we didn't know about. And so I was going to be the church, you know, person. And I was going to be the room mom. And I was going to be the den leader in scouts. And I was going to be chair of this. And I was going to chair that. I got really busy. You know, like we have an Al-Anon, when you get busy, you know, you get better. Well, I got busy, and I didn't get better, but I could ignore what was going on at home. I could make it look really good on the outside. We were the perfect family, you know, at the end of these two boys, it was like, okay, this is it, I'm quitting, you know. We stopped having kids. And, I worked really hard at trying to keep him happy, because I thought, okay, if he's depressed and suicidal, I can keep him from being that way. I can be the great cook. I can be the great lover. I can be the one that always can change his, get him happy, you know, change, and life is good. Keep the kids away from him if he was in a bad, you know. I would make those phone calls all day long about how you doing, you know. I want to know what's coming home, but that's not how I would say it. I would, you know. But I know today I was checking to see how he was doing and what I would do. And again, I lived in fear. I lived in fear of coming home, you know, if he were to take his life. I didn't know what that was going to, you know. I didn't want to have the kids, and, you know, I lived in fear. Things weren't good in the marriage. Those red flags were popping up again. You know, I was seeing things that I wasn't seeing, and I was imagining that it was nothing. And I mean, it was just, I could talk myself into, that's not happening. He wouldn't do that. That's not the way it's going to be. And life is good, life is grand. Just, I'm going to keep praying harder. I'd try everything. I'd get him. He came back to church with me for a little bit of time, because I would guilt him into it. You know, these kids that I had, I'm going to raise them in the church the way I was raised. And we have to be an example as a strong couple. You know, we both support church. And he went for a while, but it just didn't work for him like it did for me. I actually took him on a pilgrimage far, far away for 9 days. And I got more spiritual, and he drank a lot. Warm beer, because they didn't have anything else. And listened to his headphones and Led Zeppelin, and as I'm out meditating and praying a lot, because I didn't have this program. See, I didn't know anything about Alan. I didn't know anything about AA. God, I wish I did. But that's neither here nor there. But part of the plan, I didn't. And I didn't have Google back then, so I couldn't Google what was going on in my family, what was wrong with these symptoms. I couldn't figure that out. So here again, this great mind of mine up here, I make up the story that this is what's wrong, and this is how you fix it. Okay, he just needs to stop drinking. That's it. Well, because his parents, well, we're seeing sign of his parents drinking, and after 5:30, they would always wait till 5:30 and drink. And then they would change into these morphine to other people, and we would get these phone calls, and we didn't know who they were. I mean, we knew who they were, but they just wasn't our sweet, loving, my in-laws. And so I would make up this thing that, you know, we'll become like them if we keep drinking, so we need to stop drinking. Because it's hereditary, I hear, you know, if you have a drinking problem. Now, I'm not reading this anywhere, but I know it. I just know it. You know, I've got all the wisdom in the world right here. I just need to access it. Wrong. But so anyway, he'll quit drinking for me. But I don't know he's doing those other things to kind of cover up. But he'd stop drinking, and guess what? You think things got better without a program? No alcohol? No medication? Well, there were some medications. But not prescribed. Some prescribed, but not all. So things got worse. And so I would think, no, go back to drinking. At least you had that. Because he would convince me he was really in a lot of stress, and he needed that alcohol to come home and relax. And see, remember, that's what I grew up with. Alcohol is there for you to sit down and relax. Have a drink. Relax. Things will be fine. And so he'd go back to drinking. And at one time, he actually will talk about that he quit for a long period of time. Well, long period, 8 months back then, and he was doing great. And then he went off with my brother-in-law's. Okay, so you know my family. My parents weren't, they drank, but they didn't ever have any abuse. But I've come to know after I got into this program, my grandfather's probably on both sides had an issue with drinking. I found out after my mom passed away from my aunt that, you know, she was a younger child, and she was the one that on Fridays, when paycheck came, he'd be off, and she'd have to go into the bars to find him, you know, and bring him home. So that started clicking. Oh, okay, my mom was raised with this. a lot of alcohol, that binging that happened in her house. And my grandmother had Alzheimer's at an early age. Her mother, and I think that was as a result of, you know, living in the disease that was hidden and no solution. Then my other grandfather, when my father was 55 years old, he was not a part of our lives really much. I saw him a few times when he came, I think, to ask for money. He was a musician, and he would travel, and when my dad was 55 years old, he found out in the obituary, his dad's obituary, that he actually had a sister, a half-sister, that he didn't know about. And he called his aunt and said, "The obituary says I have a sister." And he says, "Oh yeah, we didn't tell you this." But that grandfather had a whole nother family at the same time as my grandmother was not married to him for but a year. And he came to find out this sister was like a week different in age than he was or something. So there may have been a problem there somewhere. I don't know. He may have had a problem with alcohol. I don't know. But anyway, so there's just not healthy families. Let's put it that way. And so I'm thinking maybe that's where, okay, my brothers and brother-in-laws all like to drink. Just like I like to pick alcoholics to drink. You know, everybody I dated, I always drank. So they went out to a baseball game out of town. And Mike was a designated driver because he didn't drink. He had quit drinking for 8 months. And he was drinking his little Perrier. They go to a bar right before they get ready to go into the game. And I'm telling part of the story, but this is just kind of the way it worked for us. It's like somebody ordered a drink for him that he didn't order, and he just drank it for no reason. He didn't have AA. He didn't have any kind of anything, don't drink it. And he didn't know. I mean, he wasn't trying to stay sober. He was just stopping drinking for healthy reasons and because I didn't like it when he was drinking. Because of what was going on in the house. Because I thought the marriage wasn't going to work, and I was going to make it work. I was going to do everything I could to make it work. I was going to, I knew, but I needed to, because things weren't happening in the family like I planned that happily ever after, and I didn't know if it was going to work, so I got a job. And when my kids started school, I got a job at their school. Part-time, and then I ended up getting full-time because we needed the benefits because his company was going down and we needed the insurance, we needed stuff, and we were selling things because, as you know, in this disease, when things, the finances start to go, and we were still trying to keep up this image of who we were and what we had. And so I went back to work really out of fear that I might be on my own someday and have to raise these kids and help raise them. But I was going to fight forever about, you know, against that because I knew that's not what I believed in. I didn't believe in divorce. Anyway, so we ended up I need to jump forward here quickly. He was starting to do crazy things. And I would always have a solution. You know, you need to do this. And I've got those facts. I know how to save the world, really. And I would tell him, you need to do this, you need to do that. This is, and he'd come to me with those things. What do you need to do? And I thought I could solve everything. But he finally kept doing some crazy things that you'll hear about later. And God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. He ended up giving me no answer. I totally was baffled by some things that he was doing, that he was asking me what he should do about it. And I just said, please go get help. Please go. And it wasn't the first time I'd asked him to get help, or he'd gotten help, you know, on his own. I said, you really need to go talk to somebody. This is beyond any solution that I can come up with. And as a result, they sent him on to somebody else that sent him on to somebody else, and then we went to somebody together for, it was an addiction evaluation. And I had to fill out this paperwork and listen to this tape or something, and I didn't realize, you know, really what I was living in. I had no idea. I was just clueless. And Mike, when they came out, didn't take long for them to talk. He came out and he said, you know, pretty simple, Mike's an alcoholic. And of course, what's the Al-Anon answer to that? How do I fix it? What do I need to do? What do I need to do? He's an alcoholic, how can I fix it? The guy just told me directly, he said, pack his bags. And see, I didn't want to hear that because I've been doing everything I could to keep that from happening. You know, I did not want to pack his bags. I needed him. I needed him at the house. I've got two boys, and they were young, 8 and 11. They were starting that teenage years. I needed that man at my house to be my, you know, protector and defender and all this stuff, example. And ended up, he went into treatment. And they said, you know, he's an alcoholic. And I just wanted to cheer because, see, I couldn't figure out what was going on. Why Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde lived at my house. I never could plan who was going to be there, you know, and stuff. And I was the one that was crazy. I was the one that would figure out, okay, I'm going to confront him about this. At the end of that confrontation, I would be the one apologizing. And then I'd go, God, I can't confront him. It's always my fault. You know, it's my fault. So we started this road. You know, that was our turning point. He got into treatment, and I went through a family week there. And then the words they told me were, you know, I heard loud and clear that instead of helping him, I was enabling him. And that was really hard to hear because I thought, I've just been trying to help. I'm still trying to help people, let me tell you. Still trying to help. You know, we got into something not a month ago where I was still helping. I still want to help. That's why I keep coming back. They gave me my Al-Anon book, my One Day at a Time book. This is falling apart right now, but, you know, they gave me this and told me to go to 4 meetings. And I signed a piece of paper. If I sign a piece of paper, I know you're going to check up on me and make sure I go to those meetings and stuff. So I'm going to go to those meetings because, see, I'm a commitment person. If I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to be where I say I'm going to be when I'm going to be there at the right time. Sometimes a little late, but I'm going to be there and do it. That was drilled into me growing up. So I started going to these Al-Anon meetings because I figured, you know, I got to learn how to keep him sober. You know, they're going to teach me how to stop this enabling, which they do. And I'm going to go to these meetings. Well, see, when they pointed the finger at him saying he was an alcoholic, that freed me from any wrongdoing. I was the martyr again. I got to be the martyr. And so I didn't need to be there. I wasn't there for me. I was there for them. So the first meeting I went to, it was a little bitty room. They didn't have a newcomer meeting, so I always encourage people in Al-Anon, please go to a newcomer meeting first, because it's kind of hard. They start speaking Greek and stuff, and you don't really know what they're talking about. And what I heard them say, not that what they said, but this is what I heard them say, my filter, was that they were sick, and they were there because they were really sick, and they needed to be there to get well. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not sick. Why would I want to be here? I don't want to get what you got if you're sick. You know, because I was perfect. When I walk in these rooms, I'm the one that's working. I'm the one that's trying to keep the house. I'm paying the bills. I'm doing all this stuff. I'm doing it all just so he would not get depressed and he would be okay and keep him happy. And it was crazy. And so I still had to go to other meetings. Mike and I started going to meetings, joint meetings, and it was great. I started hearing things in those rooms. I wasn't sharing, but I was hearing about, and I got to go to newcomer meetings, and it was wonderful to listen about how I'm powerless and then my life's unmanageable. Yes, it's unmanageable. I can't manage him. I can't manage anything other than my household. I can do certain things, but I can't manage him. Can't manage his disease. And then they taught me about the second step, about how, you know, how powerful, sanity and all this stuff, and about some of the crazy things I've done. And then it can be restored. And okay, I was raised in that religion, and I felt like I was, you know, taught that, and I believed in that. I'm willing for God. I had actually surrendered Mike a couple of years before I came into these rooms. I remember being at church by myself in a little chapel, and just at a loss, totally lost. And I remember, you know, getting on my knees and just say, God, like y'all do, I can't do it. I've tried everything, you know, from every kind of manipulation, every kind of guilt trip, everything to get him, to get us better. And I just finally, I gave it. So I knew I'd done that third step. Fourth step is looking at me. How can I look at me? I'm still perfect, so really there's nothing wrong with me right now. I'm sure I've got a few things, but this is early on in recovery when I've got my long list of defects today. And, you know, talking to somebody, that's easy. In my religion, I would go and confess to a priest on a regular basis, so I had that covered. I had all these steps covered, so I didn't need a sponsor, see. I'd done all that. Making amends, you don't need to make amends when you're perfect. I mean, you know, yeah, people can make amends to me, sure, but I don't have amends to make early on. I carried on once every now and then going to these meetings. It was because, you know, I got to go with Mike. We would go to meetings together. And I got the kids involved at Alateen. They told me to take them to Alateen. They started going to Alateen meetings, and they loved it. So it was great. As a family, we would go to meetings, you know, the four of us. He'd drop us off at our Al-Anon meeting and go across the street to the AA meeting. And it was wonderful. You know, it was like we're having this recovery family. And all was going to be great. And that lasted about 8 or 9 months, maybe. And Mike dropped a bombshell on me. And because he's heard this stuff about rigorous honesty and decided he needed to be rigorously honest with me about some infidelities that had happened for the last 8 years before we got into program. That all those red flags I'm talking about that were not there were there. He dropped it out of the blue without sponsorship, letting him know that he should be doing that. Other than that, he'll talk about that too. Well, that's what I needed, because that put me in pain. That put me in a place where I had heard in these meetings of somebody that had gone through something similar and wanted their marriage to last, and they were surviving it. So I grabbed this person, and that's why I like to share, you know, at meetings when the opportunity arises, that I've lived through that and I've survived that. And I grabbed these people before the meeting, after me, and we'd meet for coffee or whatever, and I'd say, how did you do it? I don't know if this marriage is going to survive. I'm going to keep, literally, we had to live one day at a time in this marriage. I said I would be married one day at a time. Every day, you know, I learned, you wake up and you say, can I do it today? Can I stay in this marriage today? And, you know, it was yes, I don't know. It was never a no. That's why I'm here today. It was, you know, I keep trying and doing the deal. I got involved in Al-Anon finally because I realized I needed it for me. I needed it for my kids. I needed it for my work. I needed it for my marriage. I needed it for my family members, everybody. So anyway, I got a sponsor. I started working these steps one by one. I got involved in service work. I got involved. My kids did Alateen. Once they got out, I became an Alateen sponsor. And to pay back what was given to my kids, they loved it. And I think that's where they got some recovery today. Life was good, you know. Kelly, you talked about, you know, the perfect life after recovery. Well, sorry it hadn't happened for us either. You know, life just kept happening. Life kept happening. And we, about 10 years into the program, you know, it took us about 6 years to get through that, you know, to where it was sufficient, to where I could trust him again. And I knew that maybe we had a chance. And it was one day at a time. Y'all walked us through every bit of that, one day at a time. And it wasn't easy. It was very hard. But we got to learn a lot about each other and ourselves. How to live in a marriage. And I'm on sponsor number four now, because my first sponsor, our schedules started clashing. We weren't able to connect, and I really needed somebody at the time. Got a lady that I knew that was going to kick my you know what, and then and make me, I mean, be honest with me. And not that the first one wasn't, because she loved me through what I needed to be loved through. You get your sponsor at the right time. You know, for me, it's worked out that way. I've had the right sponsor at the right time. Second one was, you know, we worked hard. We actually worked, you know, after I'd done the steps with my first sponsor, I've worked them through the big book with my second sponsor, and I've worked through really some tough stuff. She ended up, after several years, graduating. She divorced her alcoholic and graduated, and so I had to get a third sponsor, and that third sponsor was the perfect sponsor again, that taught me how to have fun and how to enjoy life and to blow bubbles and take a bubble bath and do things for me, because it was like, what do you enjoy doing, Diane? Well, see, I don't know what I enjoy doing, because I knew what he did, what the kids did, but see, I did everything for everybody else, never for me. And so I was learning who Diane was. Part of my meditation this morning was, who is Diane? I got to find out through that sponsor. That sponsor ended up moving away, and we tried to do long distance for a while, but I knew that I needed somebody face-to-face, and I got the sponsor I have today that is just perfect again. But some of those things that Mike and I have used, that I've needed the program for, you know, as I say, it took us 6 years to get through the first thing, and of course, boys, teenage years, I needed the program for that, you know, normal crazy stuff. But guys, I'm so grateful I was in this program for that. Y'all have taught me how to walk through these things that were just really tough, really tough. You taught me how to be a mom and let my kids be kids. 10 years in recovery, we got hit with some stuff too. My oldest son, well, let's see, I don't know which order we were in, I guess. My oldest son was in college. My youngest son in eighth grade, the year before that, got kicked out of school. He was caught with some marijuana in his shoe, and they had zero tolerance in Tennessee. And, I mean, here we were, Alateen, AA, Al-Anon, how do you do that? You know, you were supposed to be healed. You were fine. You know, we're perfect. You know better. Well, it wasn't his, of course. It was somebody else's, all that story. And, of course, I want to believe him. But anyway, he got kicked out. So I got to use that first sponsor through everything. It was like I had to get him in another school because he got kicked out. He was in public school. Nobody wants him eighth grade, mid-year, joining a private school because he was out of Metro. And I worked diligently trying to go interview and get him in. Nobody wanted him. And I know my sponsor was tired of hearing about all of it, and she finally just said, Diane, why don't you let go and let God? Okay, so how's God going to get him in school? Well, see, I was doing the footwork, but then I wasn't leaving it up to God, because I did the footwork, but I didn't leave it to God. I was worried and worried and worried. I lived in that worried place, and so I said, okay. Now, this is early on, and I said, I didn't trust yet. God was supposed to handle these things. It's down here. God's taking care of wars. I'm taking care of the rest. I got to take care of all this stuff. And I just said, okay. This was a Monday. And I said, okay. God's got till Friday. Because on Friday, it's going to be a month he's out of school. And I'm going to have to quit school where I work and homeschool him, because he's going to graduate eighth grade. And so I gave God till Friday, and I let go of it, you know. Well, Thursday night, I get a phone call. Yes, God called me. By the form of somebody else, we had an appointment the next day, Friday, at the ALC, which is the Alternative Learning Center in Nashville, that met for those people that had gotten kicked out of school that for either drugs or, you know, guns or something. And of course, I didn't think he needed to be there because he wasn't like that. So what every mom thinks of their child, I didn't want to believe that. But anyway, he went to the ALC for a year, and it's exactly where he needed to be. At the end of the year, they graduate, and he got all these honors and everything. It was fabulous to watch. You know, again, God got to show me, look, I know what's better. Because I thought, yeah, God, okay, let's see if this is going to work out. And it did. it worked, and I thought, oh God, thank you. You do know better. So then I was able to give him more, more and more. I was able to turn those things over. And so we got through that. And then like the next, 3 years later, we get the oldest child, my oldest son's in college, and he gets engaged like that Thanksgiving. But they're putting it off, a wedding 2.5 years down the road, which I thought, good, they haven't known each other long, they'll know each other by then if it works out and stuff, that's wonderful. And so that's happens, and then in February, we always go to the Huntsville Roundup. I was talking about that earlier. We always go to the Huntsville Roundup. We love going there. And it just so happened that year the right people were speaking that I needed to hear. People that had been in the pen and stuff and sharing their story, how they got recovery there and all this kind of stuff. Well, that's a 4-day event for us. And we came home Sunday. Oh, back up, just my youngest son at 18, in between his junior and senior year, decided he wanted to move out of the house. And because Al-Anon, you taught me how to let him go. He was 18, and I wished him well. You know, I loved him, and I wish you well. If it works, it works. If it doesn't work, you'll figure it out and do it something different. I had to turn him loose, and y'all held my hand through all of that. Well, that February, we come home from the Huntsville Roundup, and we find out my two children, one's in college in Kentucky, Western Kentucky, and this one is, you know, living in his thing, and we'd stayed connected, but he came home. We come home, and there they are in our living room, and we're like, what are y'all doing here? Well, come have a seat. Like, okay, just what you want to hear. So you know something's happened. My youngest son informs us then at that time that previous Thursday, which we always left on Thursday to go to the Huntsville, that he'd gotten arrested. And he had 3 felonies and a misdemeanor and had gone to jail. And so how are you out of jail? And he said, well, he'd rounded up the money and stuff, and my oldest son went and bailed him out. So he may need to be in our program, I don't know, but he bailed him out. And with the money that they'd rounded up and gotten him out the next day. And because of AA and Al-Anon, we got to say, we love you. You'll be able to take care of it. We'll support you in love. But that's it. You get to find the lawyer. You get to do the deal. You get to pay for the lawyers. And we'll love you through it. Whatever's supposed to be. Because I knew, I'd heard those people speak. And if my son was supposed to find recovery, because see, when I let him go, I let him go, and he got into a lot of stuff. He'd quit school, he dropped out. I didn't know any of this stuff. I stayed out of his business. I got to stay out of his business and let him be a young adult. And as a result, he did find a lawyer. He did pay for the lawyer. He got a 2-year probation. He asked to move back home. And, you know, it was under the conditions that he'd go back to school, finish school, and no drugs, no alcohol allowed in the house. And he did come home, and those 2 years were beautiful. We got to just sit by and watch him, you know, do the deal. And, of course, he was court-ordered to some meetings and all this stuff that he did attend, but he didn't think he needed to be there. The oldest son called up Mike and stuff, and that February too, and said, well, how do you and Mom feel about being grandparents? Someday that'd be great. How about August? And I'm like, okay, so do we move the wedding date up this summer? No, we're going to keep it 2 years down the road. And I'm like, okay, thank you AA and Al-Anon for letting me say okay. You don't have to do it my way. You get to do it your way. And we got to love them through that. You know, he quit college, came home and got a job, and was raised that family ever since. 2 years later, they got married. We got to watch that, our granddaughter, I got to have my little girl walk down the aisle, you know, at their marriage. A few years later, about 4 years later, we got to watch them walk through a divorce like I've never seen. Y'all held my hand through all of that. You taught us how to love. Unconditionally, because see, anybody got divorced in my family, you didn't have anything else to do with them. Today, we are still close to that granddaughter's, that mother. She's borrowing our truck today to go help move some stuff. You know, we stay connected. We have all the holidays together. We have her boyfriend, my son, and his girlfriend over. We have a big family group as a family. You've taught us how to love everyone, in it, regardless of what they've done. My son remarried. We divorced. We've walked through all this stuff. I lost my father during this time. I got to make amends to him and in a way, love him in a way I've never loved him. When he left, it was wonderful. I got to do that with my brother, too, in this program. And I'm going to wrap it up now with the latest life thing that keeps happening. In May, our granddaughter came to us and was graduating high school, and she informed us that she was going to be graduating as, instead of her name, as a guy's name, and walking in a guy's robe, because she's transgender and she's going to become a man. So that kind of, I mean, we've kind of known some stuff, and I've taken her and bought guy's clothes for the last 3 years, but she informed us of that, and we waited for her to tell us, you know, rather than questioning her, what was going on, why is she dressing this way, and all that kind of stuff. We let her be her and love her the way she needed to be. And I'm getting now to call her a him. So if you've been wondering why I've been crossing granddaughter to grandson to grandchild, he, she, it's all the same person. We got to have lunch with him yesterday. And in December, he'll have some surgery that we're getting to support. I got to kind of grieve that little girl that I got to have for 18 years. But it was such a blessing, because now that I'm with them, it's the same person. I'm just taking the outside roles. It's the same person here. You've taught me how to love from the inside, not the outside. It's not how you look. It's here. We are still connected. The tears of gratitude. Thank you for giving me this wonderful life. Taught me how to love, really love. Not from my head, but from my heart. And I'm going to close with this. Reading out of our One Day at a Time. August 6th. This is a day which God has given into my hands. If I could only realize what a tremendous gift this is, I would use every moment of it to make my life more serene, more rewarding. I would notice interesting things, the expression on people's faces, a plant growing on my windowsill, the grace and charm of a child, an arrangement of clouds. Today there are wonders all around me if I will only open my eyes and enjoy them, because you have taught me how to open my eyes and my heart. Thank you.